This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening and welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. On tonight's program, we'll be talking to John Kerman about an Earth Day lobbying event that he's a part of in Jefferson City. Also, we'll be talking to Professor Don Stull. Don is an applied anthropologist at KU and the author of Slaughterhouse Blues. He has worked for over 40 years on the critical agricultural issues surrounding livestock and meatpacking. As a researcher, analyst, and educator, Professor Stull is focused on the biggest challenge facing family farmers and ranchers, the corporate monopolization of meatpacking. We'll be talking to him in a little later in the program about his illustrious career, as well as the event that the Environmental Law Society is putting on in his honor. But first, some news. The Los Angeles Times reports that new data from the United Nations Environment Program shows that for the first time in 3 years, investment in renewable power and fuels jumped, rising 17% in 2014 to $270.2 billion globally. The article notes that renewable generation worldwide also made up a greater percentage of the total power generated, rising from 8.5% in 2013 to 9.1% in 2014. The Times further details the new data, identifying trends specific to areas of the globe and specific types of renewable power. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that Southern Company announced Tuesday that it is acquiring a wind project in Oklahoma that will be the Atlanta-based company's largest renewable electric generating plant to date. Southern Company subsidiary Southern Power is acquiring the 299-megawatt K wind facility from Apex Clean Energy, which will operate the Oklahoma plant for Southern. The facility will use 130 wind turbines made by the Siemens Energy, which has a major presence in Metro Atlanta. According to the article, Southern Power has been growing its renewable energy generating business and now has nearly a dozen solar projects either completed or in the works, including several planned for Georgia in Taylor and Decatur counties. And the Denver Business Journal reports in its Earth to Power blog that Vestas Wind Systems ranked first in the world for new turbines installed in 2014. Vestas has four manufacturing plants in Colorado. In his column, in the Arizona Republic, Robert Robb writes that Tucson Electric Power's proposal to write rooftop solar customers at the wholesale price of power rather than the retail price should be the end of a very contentious discussion. He writes that the plan has elegance and logic to it, but cautions against TEP's cost shift claim and fees for solar customers. Bloomberg News reports that TerraForm Power purchased 168 megawatts of capacity from its parent Sun Edison for about $110 million. And Bloomberg also reports that Mexico has set a national target of getting 5% of its power from renewable sources by 2018. The target is lower than the 8.2% described in an earlier draft policy. Also, the Department of Energy is moving forward with new efficiency rules. According to The Hill, they're working with new efficiency rules for pumps. Their Office of Efficiency and Renewable Energy proposed yesterday to develop new test procedures for measuring the efficiency of pumps. The procedures would measure the electric input, hydraulic power, and shaft power of pumps. Excuse me. And the EPA Region 7, which is located here in Lenexa, has announced that they made a settlement with a Jefferson County, Missouri property owner to resolve Clean Water Act violations involving unpermitted discharges of pollutants into an unnamed tributary of Belize Creek. As part of the settlement, Greg Schellert has agreed to pay a penalty of $30,000 and fully restore the impacted portion of the tributary. A U.S. Army Corps of Engineers inspection in March of 2014 documented that Schellert violated the Clean Water Act when he or others working on his behalf used earth-moving equipment to discharge fill material into the tributary as a part of work associated with the construction of a dam. The tributary is classified as a water of the U.S. by the Clean Water Act. The work was performed without a permit pursuant to Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. And Reuters is reporting that California oil producers used 214 acre-feet of water, equivalent to nearly 70 million gallons, in the process of fracking for oil and gas in the state last year, despite record drought conditions in California. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. John Kerman back to Eco Radio KC. Hello, John.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to have the opportunity to be here. Hopefully the listeners aren't tired of hearing from me yet.
No, I don't think so. That's why we keep having you back, because you always have a lot to share, and we appreciate both your analysis and the active part of it, the acting upon that analysis as well. So that's part of why you're here to talk about tonight.
Absolutely. So the big timely thing we want to talk about now is, of course, Earth Day is coming up. April 22nd is Earth Day every year. This year, that falls on a Wednesday. And what's different about Earth Day this year is something that, as far as I know, and I've been doing activism for 21 years in the Kansas City area now, something unprecedented is going to happen in Jefferson City on Earth Day. There's going to be a rally called Take Back Earth Day. It's both a rally and a lobby day. And what's going to happen is, starting at 10 a.m., folks who travel to Jefferson City are going to start meeting with their legislators in the General Assembly, their representatives, and their senators, their state senators. And then at 2 p.m., there will be a rally in the rotunda of the Capitol. So this is right in the face of the Missouri General Assembly, as well as the governor, Governor Nixon. And what's unprecedented about this is that I am not aware of this ever happening before in the history of Missouri, where groups, statewide groups, as well as locally based groups, are coming together to get bodies out to rally. Not lobby days have happened before, but this rally aspect of it and this working together of these different groups is what's really unprecedented here. And we're hoping to turn out at least hundreds of people. It'd be great to go over 1,000 for this thing. Obviously, it's on a weekday. Has to be on a weekday if you're going to meet with your representatives and senators and get some media coverage, we hope. But we'd really like it if lots of people came out. I just want to talk some about the different groups that are pulling together to do this. And they're doing this not as a one-off either. This event is the first big public event of a new organization, a group called the Missouri Clean Energy Coalition. And just to give you an idea of the breadth of this organization, we have statewide groups, the Missouri Chapter of the Sierra Club, Missouri Coalition for the Environment, Renew Missouri, the New Populists in Action, which is based here in Kansas City but is working statewide, Missouri Pro Vote. Those are the Missouri Interfaith Power and Light. Don't want to leave them out. And in addition to those statewide groups, there are groups that are working more on a local basis, like the 350KC that I work with, the Labadee Environmental Organization, which started up to work on the problems, particularly with coal ash from the Labadee coal-fired power plant in the eastern part of the state. The Ethical Society of St. Louis, frankly, I don't even know exactly what they are, but I find it really interesting that they're part of this coalition. I haven't learned about them yet. Columbia-based Peaceworks. We haven't gotten Peaceworks Kansas City in yet, but perhaps we will. which also has a Missourians for Safe Energy project there, the Central Reform Congregation, and also the Organizing for Action Climate Team. If probably some of our listeners remember that Organizing for America grew out of Obama for America. So it's interesting that that they're playing a role in this too. So we're looking to expand this coalition, but in the most timely fashion, what we want to do is we want to get people to show up in Jefferson City. So if listeners out there are interested in doing that, taking part in this lobby and rally day, you can send an email to 350kclead, L-E-A-D, at gmail.com. I'll try to get that up on our Facebook page in case you are in a position where you can't write it down. That's 350kclead at gmail.com. And we're still in the early stages of figuring out carpooling here from Kansas City. Most of the organizations that are involved in this coalition are based in the St. Louis area. The statewide organizations, for pretty obvious reasons, St. Louis is a bigger metropolitan area. But we want to get a good showing from folks out here in Kansas City, too. Now, what is this coalition planning to work on? You probably are interested in that. You want to know more than just Take Back Earth Day. What are we taking back? It's the Clean Energy Coalition. And so our primary impetus is to work for statewide policies here in Missouri that will push clean energy forward and therefore cut carbon pollution and get us on a path to a climate-safe future. First and foremost is to have a really strong Missouri clean energy plan. As listeners have no doubt heard on this show in the past, if they're regular listeners, the EPA has proposed the Clean Power Plan to cut carbon and pollution from from all power plants, as well as some other facilities, but primarily from power plants. And in that proposal, every state is called on to implement its own plan, what's called a state implementation plan. Now, states can opt out of creating their own plans to meet the targets set by the EPA in the Clean Power Plan, but if they do, the EPA will create a plan for those states. Now, there's been an interesting political development lately. Senator Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican majority leader of the Senate, and of course the Republicans have control of the Senate, has called on states to opt out of creating their own plans, which that's a really interesting and, in my opinion, deplorable interference by a member of the Senate, even the Republican leader of the Senate, in state politics to call on state governments to actually opt out. Now, of course, here in Missouri, with the Republicans being in control of both the House and the Senate in the General Assembly, there's going to be a lot of sentiment against creating a state implementation plan here anyway. Of course, we have a Democratic governor who had started his own process to create a governor's energy plan last year, which could dovetail with the creation of our state implementation plan, but it could go in another direction too. We don't know exactly what's going to come out of that. So that's why this fact that Republicans are actively opposed to the EPA's Clean Power Plan, that we really need, and the fact that the Republicans control the General Assembly here in Missouri, that we really need to get as many bodies out as possible for this rally and lobby day in Jefferson City. So again, if you're interested in taking part in that, send an email to 350kclead, L-E-A-D, at gmail.com, and we'll try to get some travel arrangements together here. So,
and I did post that on both the episode of tonight's Eco Radio program. That email address is there as well on Eco Radio's Facebook
Great.
Page.
Thank you, Mike.
So, one thing I've got to say, it sounds like quite a coalition mm-hmm. building there. That's really mm-hmm. good. And I'm ashamed to admit, I didn't know there was a Missouri Interfaith Power and Light.
Well, it's fairly new. Yes. Kansas Interfaith Power and Light has been around for a while and has been more active. Missouri Interfaith Power and Light, I'm not sure when they started, but it was more recent. And I'm not sure how active they've been so far, but they are involved in this coalition, and hopefully they'll be ramping up. Each of these groups will continue to do their own separate work, but there's a certain bailiwick, you might call, that we're agreeing on to work together. Mm-hmm. We're working on, you know, an understanding of the things we work together and how we'll work together, who will speak for us and what level of participation there is in the coalition and all those sorts of bureaucratic details that have to be worked out when you form a coalition of groups with overlapping but somewhat diverse interests. This is the sort of thing that we've really needed for a very long time. Too many groups working on their own agendas, again, often overlapping, but not really working together on the areas that overlap in the way that we need to deal with what is literally a climate crisis, a problem, a crisis, that there really comes a point at which it's too late to avoid the disastrous results. There is, as I've discussed on this show in the past, you really can run out of time to deal with this and prevent it from becoming a catastrophe. Mm. So I think it's great. Again, this is, in my 21 years, I've never heard of anything being done like this in Jefferson City. And I think it's an outgrowth, at least in part, of organizations seeing how the model pursued by 350.org, the International Grassroots Climate Action Campaign, has energize the climate movement in a way that nothing in the past had done. And that's by through these days of action, national and international days of action, where you get people up from out in front of their computers, out in front of their TVs, get them out in the streets, because really in the end, big social change movements, and that's the only thing that's going to make this happen, are pushed when people are angry and outraged enough to get out into the streets and really demanding change when they're no longer willing to let the status quo be.
All right. John, I know you have to get to a meeting. Was there something else we wanted to let our listeners know about, or you want to repeat anything before you?
Just again, if you'd like to take part in this unprecedented rally in Jeff City, 350kclead@gmail.com. If you want to get interested, get involved in 350KC's work, that's the way to get in touch with us as well. We're still working on tar sands. The Keystone XL fight we've been working on for a few years seems to be about to come to an end, and the way we want it to end, with a rejection of Keystone XL, but we still have these exploding oil bomb trains to work on. Those are running through Kansas City here. We're working on that, and there are multiple other tar sands pipelines to deal with, coal plants. We have no shortage of work, folks. Join us in the fight.
Thank you so much for all you do, and thanks for stopping by here and out of your busy day. And we'll have Professor Don Stahl on after these messages and current cast.
The Hollywood Press argues that white actors are now being discriminated against. Find out what Counterspin has to say Tuesday at 6:30 p.m.
The role of unfettered capitalism, because it is all about exploitation, means that on every level it has become a deeply destructive force. I mean, 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts and shale oil races up there to drop $500 million drill bits down to profit off the death throes of the planet.
Chris Hedges on Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
On the next Making Contact, reporter Daniel Grossman takes us to India in the heat of the moment. Sea level rise, Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
Dams, balancing the good and the bad on this current cast. Depending on the need, dams can create a reservoir to hold water, protect from floods, or generate clean electricity. But a dam physically blocks migrating fish and changes the overall biology of the life in the river by changing the natural water flow. Laura Wisland with the Union of Concerned Scientists says it's not the size of the dam that matters.
The larger dam that creates ways for fish passage and releases water with a flow cycle that mimics the natural flow cycle that could end up having much fewer environmental impacts than a smaller dam that's poorly managed.
So design and management are of utmost importance when it comes to minimizing environmental risks. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And back in the studio here, if you're listening to Eco Radio KC, my name is Mike Murphy. Thanks again to John Kerman for joining us. But now we're going to our next guest, who's Professor Don Stahl, an applied anthropologist at KU and author of Slaughterhouse Blues. He's put in a career of over 40 years on agricultural issues surrounding livestock and meat packing, and he will be celebrated up at an event coming up at the KU Ecumenical Building, ECM, at the corner of 12th and Jayhawk on Thursday, April 16th. We'll hear more all about that from Professor Don Stahl. Professor Stahl, thanks for joining us here on Eco Radio KC.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Sure. So do I understand this correctly, like you are retiring at the end of this semester? Or?
Yeah, this is the end of my 40th year at KU, so it seemed like a good time to close out my career at KU.
And
so I haven't been doing research on the meat and poultry industry for 40 years, but for 30.
Right.
But I've been at KU for 40, so I'm retiring at the end of this semester.
So the first 10 years you were working on other things, or?
I was working on other things. I came to KU as a specialist in American Indians and the issues related to that, and about in the mid 1980s I became interested in the influx of immigrants from Southeast Asia and Latin America to Southwest Kansas, to Garden City. And so I led a team of researchers that did a two-year study of relations between immigrants and established residents in Garden City. And what brought them to Garden City was the meatpacking industry. And so from there, I began studying the industry, first in Southwest Kansas with beef, and then also in western Nebraska, and then in the Oklahoma Panhandle in pork production. And then since the late 1990s, I have been studying my home. I'm from western Kentucky, and my home county, which has a Tyson chicken plant nearby.
So I'm curious about you did a study on the relationship of the immigrants to, for a lack of a better word, the locals. Or maybe that is the right word. So how was that relationship?
Well, people came to find work, and there was plenty of work in the packing industry. So the kind of ethnic tension that might have occurred had there been competition for jobs really didn't. And so we looked at relationships in the workplace and in the schools, in the community. And most recently, I've been back in the Garden City schools with a colleague from the School of Education, looking at how educators serve the needs of a school district that's about 78% of people of color, children of color.
Wow. So that's fascinating right there. That's not what people think, probably, as they fly over.
No, it's not what I thought. I didn't think of Southwest Kansas as being a multicultural mecca, but that's what it is. It's a minority-majority community. It was the first in the state, and also Dodge City Liberal in the southwest corner also had the same kind of dynamics.
And so I'm curious, you know, my perception of rural Kansas is that, you know, it's everyone lives there is on a farm, so like, If you're going to work in some kind of factory setting, where do those people live? Do apartment buildings spring up, or do
well? The in most of rural America, low-income housing is trailer parks. And so if you travel to western Kansas, you'll find lots of, well, Garden City has one trailer park on the eastern edge that's over 500 units. But it's, you know, the rural America has industrialized over the last 25 to 30 years, largely focusing around adding value to agricultural products. And so the main growth in employment in rural America in the 1980s was largely in beef packing in the High Plains, and then in the 90s in poultry and pork production in the Southeast. And so what we've seen is the growth in rural America has come from really industrial factory jobs in what are essentially meat factories. And so a lot of that really relates to the fact that we're eating a lot more meat than we used to. So we eat about 200 per capita meat consumption in America is about 200 pounds per year. And that's up about 70 pounds from what it was a century ago. And so most of that meat is produced in what are called concentrated animal feeding operations, commonly called CAFOs. And that's become really the norm for producing livestock in the last half century. And, you know, the problems from that arise really over the fact that these CAFOs are large. They're putting a lot of animals in a very small area. And the operations are densely concentrated in certain areas. So, for example, Arkansas is a major producer of poultry, chickens. It produces over a billion chicken broiler, what are called broilers, or eating chickens every year. And those 20% of those billion plus chickens are grown in two counties. So what that means is you've got lots of animals concentrated in very small areas, and of course they produce a lot of waste, and that's where the environmental issues become important. So, for example, a chicken, an eating chicken, a broiler, for every pound of, for every 2 pounds that you feed a chicken, he produces 1 pound of gain. And so the average eating chicken's about 5.5 pounds. And that produces about a half a pound of dry waste by the time you dry out the moisture in the waste. And if you mix, and the floors of those houses are covered in rice hulls or wood chips, and that's called chicken litter. And so chicken houses, my part of Kentucky, they're roughly 500 feet long and about 40 feet wide, so about the length of 1.5 football fields and about the width of a quarter of a football field, basically. And each one of those houses will produce about 200 tons of litter a year. So, you know, that's just this huge amount of waste. And
highly concentrated, right?
And it's concentrated. So, for example, I come from the county that has the largest number of chicken houses in the state of Kentucky. It has about 230 chicken houses, each one holding, they hold about 25,000 birds.
Wow.
And from the time an egg is hatched until the time the egg is laid until the chicken hatches, that's about 3 weeks. And then from the time the chicken is born until it goes to slaughter is about 7 weeks. So in that 7 weeks, that animal goes from a little bitty chicken that weighs almost nothing to being about 5.5 pounds. And you turn over, each one of those flocks turns over about 7 times. So it's a lot of birds and a lot of manure.
And so
you think of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and so with a lot of that manure comes a lot of, like, flies and things like that. And then with a lot of flies comes a lot of insecticide. Is that, am I oversimplifying?
Well, yeah, there's lots of flies. The Now, that chicken litter is cleaned out about once a year or so and then spread on fields as fertilizer. It's a wonderful fertilizer. I mean, it's rich in potassium, it's rich in nitrogen. But the problem is it's spread within the local area. And so what that means is you get really lots and lots of nutrients put into ground locally, and that eventually gets saturated and can lead and can cause problems with runoff, for example. And the other thing you don't think about, you mean you think about the chicken poop, the litter, but the other real problem is that is the production of ammonia.
Yeah.
And so a single chicken house produces about 5 tons of ammonia a year. And so
wow.
That creates real problems for the people that work in those houses or the people that live nearby. So just to give you another example, that's chickens, but hogs. Of course, there are lots of chickens grown in Missouri, none really in Kansas. Lots of hogs grown in Missouri as well. Each hog produces about 3,000 pounds of solid manure and about 500 gallons of liquid manure.
Wow.
And that's about 2.5 times what a human produces. And so you've got this a massive amount of waste that's being produced in a very, very small area. And so that manure for hogs is held in what are called lagoons.
Yeah.
And then ultimately it gets spread either a solid fertilizer or liquid fertilizer onto farmland in that local area. And I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with some of the fish kills that have occurred in Missouri as a result of ruptured waste lagoons
mm-hmm.
and flooding.
Yeah.
And so so that's something we hear about in the news fairly often. What we don't hear about is the fact that the people that work in those confinement facilities and the people that live nearby suffer a lot of respiratory problems.
Yeah, I bet.
About a third of people that work in hog barns suffer from health problems, mainly respiratory, but things like nausea and depression and diarrhea, things like that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would think that kind of job might generate some PTSD in some of the workers as well.
Maybe. I don't know. There certainly studies have found that individuals who work in those facilities, when comparing them to control groups, have much higher rates of anger, fatigue, depression. So I haven't seen any studies that have called it PTSD, but it certainly has symptoms that are similar to that.
Well, this is fascinating. I'd really like to have you on maybe so we can discuss this at further length at some point. But before I let you go, I do want to find out about this event that the Environmental Law Society and the Kansas Rural Center and the Kansas Farmers Union are hosting with you.
Well, it's Thursday night, April 16th at 7:30 at ECM, which, as you said, was at the corner of 12th and Jayhawk, so it's right next to the Oriette Hotel. If people have that as a landmark,
do people need?
And so I'll be talking about these issues, but about in general, sort of looking at the meat and poultry industry and the consequences for farmers and for workers and for the general public. And sort of just talking about the issues that I've been looking at now for 30 years and talking about ways that we might begin to address some of these problems.
Well, good luck with that and good luck with everything. It's, I mean, you put in a long, illustrious career, and so I'm glad you're getting a little honor, and I'm Well, I hope things go well for you, and I'd like to touch base with you again and maybe discuss things at further length, if that's okay.
Well, I'd be happy to, and thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Professor Don Stull, the name of his book is Slaughterhouse Blues, and again, he'll be speaking on April 16th at the KU ECM building, which is at 12th and Jayhawk. That's at 7:30 p.m. Thank you again, Professor Stull.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. All right. Okay, we're going to go now to a press conference that the EPA held on the phone the other day regarding apparently emissions from cars have gone down. So we'll find out a little bit about that. But first, we're going to hear a couple more messages.
Cities across the country are laying off municipal workers to contract with private for-profit firms to furnish municipal services, encouraged by the American Legislative Exchange Council and other such councils as the Heritage Foundation. Kansas City Councilman John Sharp, a frequent critic of privatization, explains the issue on the All Souls Forum this Wednesday, 6 p.m. right here on KKFI.
KKFI is hosting the People of Color Community Forum on April 14th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the station located at 3901 Main, second floor. The purpose of the community forum is to identify needs and opportunities for both KKFI and the People of Color community in helping KKFI stay local and vocal as it carries out its mission statement. Please join us.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
How do you make climate change relevant to high school students?
That's the question that Finn Ryan at the Wisconsin Media Lab set out to answer.
And that's kind of how we got onto the idea of, well, let's use story to look at climate change impacts in Wisconsin, and then use a collection of stories that hopefully any student in Wisconsin can identify with at least one of the stories so they find some relevance.
The result is a collection of multimedia stories. For example, how warmer temperatures are affecting the annual American Birkebeiner cross-country ski race in Hayward, Wisconsin.
And this really made it a way for a teacher to say, well, here is something that is happening in our community, and then the students know about that, and then they start to think, oh, well, there's less snow. How does that impact this event?
Even students who do not cross-country ski, or Birky as it's called by locals, can relate the changes in snowfall to their own experiences, such as with snowboarding. Other stories describe the impact of global warming on maple sugaring and fly fishing, traditional Wisconsin activities that bring home the relevance of climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hi, good morning and welcome. My name is Christy St. Clair from the press office. Thank you for joining us. Today we'll be discussing the new report issued by the Environmental Protection Agency, Greenhouse Gas Emission Standards for Light Duty Vehicles, the Manufacturer Performance Report for the 2013 model year. On the call, we have Janet McCabe, the Acting Assistant Administrator for EPA's Office of Air, and Christopher Grundler, Office Director for the Office of Transportation and Air Quality. And in a moment, I'll turn the call over to Ms. McCabe, who will brief you on the report, and then I'll open the line up for questions. And I know the operator mentioned it earlier, but if you want to ask a question, please press star one, and then you'll be added into the queue. And we'll be asking for you to limit your questions to one per reporter. Janet McCabe.
Thanks, Christy, and thanks to all of you for joining us this morning. As she said, I'm here with Chris Grundler, I think most of you know, the Director of the Office of Transportation and Air Quality at EPA. We have some very good news to share with you this morning about the auto industry, family budgets for American families, and the environment. The news is contained in EPA's second annual Manufacturer's Performance Report, which covers model year 2013 light-duty vehicles. As you know, the president has called for EPA to take action to reduce harmful greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to climate change around the globe and in this country as part of his comprehensive climate action plan. Today, we're talking about a program that is helping in this effort while also having tremendous positive impacts for American families in terms of how much money they spend on gasoline. Today, EPA is releasing its second manufacturer performance report, which continues to mark progress for the second year of the National Clean Cars Program. It shows that automakers are well on their way in meeting the program requirements. As you remember, I'm sure, EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, developed a national program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve fuel economy for new vehicles, light-duty vehicles, through 2025. And I think it's always worth reminding ourselves of the importance of this national program. It will essentially double fuel economy across the nation. The average American family will save thousands of dollars at the gas pump, and it will slash the amount of carbon pollution that vehicles put into our air. Specifically, the projected economic benefits from this program amount to more than $1.7 trillion in fuel costs over the life of the program and will reduce America's dependence on oil by more than 2 million barrels per day in 2025. And consumers who purchase a new vehicle in 2025 will save more than $8,000 in fuel costs over that vehicle's lifetime. The environmental and public health benefits are just as remarkable. This program will cut 6 billion, and that's billion with a B, metric tons of greenhouse gases over the lifetimes of new vehicles sold between 2012 and 2025. That's more than the total amount of carbon dioxide emitted by the United States in 2010. So let me talk about the report for a minute. Today's report takes a close look at the second year of this 14-year program. It measures auto manufacturers' performance towards meeting these historic standards and presents detailed information about how individual firms are complying. The primary takeaway message from the report is that for the second consecutive model year, the automotive industry outperformed the national greenhouse gas emission standards by a wide margin. Overall, industry compliance in model year 2013 was 12 grams per mile, or 1.4 miles per gallon better than required by the 2013 standard. And they did this even though the 2013 standard is significantly tougher than the 2012 target. In addition, the majority of manufacturers representing more than 99% of sales have met both the 2012 and the 2013 standards. The report also clearly shows that the program's flexibilities are working to maintain consumer choice, spur technology innovation, and lower compliance costs for manufacturers, which is exactly what they were intended to do. Technologies like more efficient air conditioning systems and cleaner refrigerants are entering the market and are already yielding results. Innovation in body construction, transmissions, and engine design are also getting more miles per gallon and causing less greenhouse gas emissions. We're seeing that manufacturers are taking advantage of market mechanisms that were built into the program as they plan their compliance strategies and as they design future model years. These help keep costs down while ensuring steady progress toward the long-term environmental and public health goals of the program. Current trends in the industry back these findings up. New vehicle fuel economy achieved an all-time high in 2013, and technologies that increase fuel efficiency and reduce emissions are coming online even faster than anticipated. EPA's trends report shows that fuel economy has increased in 8 of the last 9 years. There are over 3 times as many 30 mile per gallon or better vehicles on the market than there were just 5 years ago. That's more choice for Americans looking to buy a car. And SUV fuel economy is increasing faster than in other vehicle types. These positive trends not only show that automakers can deliver cleaner, more efficient vehicles, but that car buyers are demanding them. That's shown by the fact that vehicle sales in 2013 rose by 1.7 million vehicles, a 13% increase from 2012 overall. We're taking all of these findings and trends as positive signs as we look to the future of this extremely important program for our country. The report shows goes to show that a well-written, flexible, and thoughtful regulatory program can be a winning proposition for automakers, car drivers, and the environment and our public health. Today's report is another promising indicator that we can effectively reduce the emissions that contribute to climate change, retain consumer choice, and save families money at the pump every day. I want to emphasize that this is the second year of a program with a long trajectory. The automakers are in this for the long view, and we are in it for the long view. But this is really important and good news early on in this program that the automakers are finding a way through it and making it such a success. Because it's such an important program and climate change is such an important challenge to address for our country's health and economy, we'll continue to keep close tabs on the program and work with the auto industry and move forward. We'll use reports like this to make sure that everyone can see and track the progress of the program and that it's all very transparent as everybody moves forward. And we will certainly plan to keep the public informed all along the way. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Christy, and we'll take some questions.
Hi, thanks everybody. So again, we'd like you to press *1 to be added to the queue for asking your question. And we ask you to just give us a few moments while we set everything up, and then we'll be right back with you. Okay, operator, we're ready to take the first question.
Your first question comes from David Shepherdson with Detroit News.
Thanks for having the call. I want to ask you just to look a little past this report. Obviously, in the 6 months since the preliminary numbers came out, oil prices have fallen dramatically, and there has been a shift by buyers to larger vehicles, SUVs, and pickups now accounting for about 55% of sales. I wonder if you're concerned that these low prices for oil are going to make it difficult for auto companies to comply and whether that's going to impact your analysis in the midterm review.
Yeah, thanks, David, for the question. A couple of responses to that. First of all, as I said before, this program takes the long view. I think everybody is familiar with the fact that gas prices go up and down over time, and the best way for people to make sure that they're going to be able to weather high gas prices or low is to invest in a fuel-efficient vehicle, and I think we're seeing people do that. The second response is to remind everybody that the way this program was set up is respectful of the choices that consumers make on the vehicles that they buy. And the important thing to know here is that whether it's a small car or a larger car, they are all getting cleaner. They are all emitting less greenhouse gases over time, and that will continue to go down. So we feel very good about the success of this program moving forward.
Okay, next caller.
Your next question comes from John Bushman with Inside Climate News.
Yes, thank you for having the call. I'd like to ask how much of the gains beyond what the program requires are attributable to the market mechanisms and credits, the air conditioning provisions, the off-cycle provisions, the provisions for all electric vehicles. Can you estimate that for me?
I'm going to turn to Chris Grundler for that question.
Yes, our estimate relative to the projections we made in our regulatory proposal is that two-thirds of this over-compliance comes from tailpipe emissions. The remaining third is made up of lower greenhouse gas emissions from improved air conditioning systems, and then a small amount of the overcompliance, roughly 14%, is from automakers taking advantage of, under current law, building flexible fuel vehicles. But this was always, I want to emphasize that we anticipated, in the design of the program, we anticipated automakers taking advantage of these different market mechanisms, as Ms. McCabe indicated. So this was always part of our projections, and the fact that the industry is doing substantially better, again, as Ms. McCabe pointed out, is very good news and tells us that this kind of innovative policy design is indeed producing the results that we expected.
Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Lee Logan with Inside EPA.
Thanks for holding the call, guys. This is another question on this issue of folks kind of responding to lower gas prices and perhaps buying a larger car because of that. How does that factor into the midterm review? You mentioned that even SUVs and trucks are getting more fuel efficient, but if more folks are buying those larger cars, does that affect how you guys look at the mid-course review?
Well, the mid-course review is a very important part of the program. Of course, this program goes all the way out to 2025, and we're looking at all the data that's available to us and will be available to us and looking at all aspects of the program. So we think that this whatever information is available, everybody will take a look at, but this is a long-term program, so a near-term trend is just that. It's a near-term trend, and we'll be looking at the long-term expectations and talking with the automakers and everybody about that as we do the midterm review. Next question.
Your next question comes from Kevin Rogers with Energy Guardian.
Hi, thanks for doing this call. I'm just getting a chance to review the report now. And I was wondering, does it include anything on how the cost of these vehicles has fluctuated over the course of this program?
No, the report is about greenhouse gas emissions and tracking with the environmental goals of the program. There's not information in there about cost.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, just a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you can press *1. Otherwise, we will wrap up. And of course, you know how to reach me, I believe. It's stclair.christie@epa.gov, or you can also email us at press@epa.gov. If you have any further questions, we see no more. So at this point, we'll wrap up. Thank you, everybody, so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference.
And that was an EPA conference call, press conference call, held last week with regard to their report of lowered emissions from automobiles. And try and get more of that kind of stuff. Appreciate your listening today. We just have a couple of things on the calendar. And the Eat Local and Organic Expo, 17th Annual Exhibition of Farmers. Their Missouri side happens this weekend at Penn Valley Community College Gymnasium. That's this Saturday, April 11th, from 9:30 to 2:30 p.m. More information at kcfoodcircle.org. There will also be workshops for kids of all ages by Dana McDaniel of Seed Saver. And that's Eat Local and Organic Expo, this Saturday. Also this Saturday, Lawrence celebrates Earth Day with a parade. There's a parade at 11 a.m. starting at Buford Watson Park. And then parades down to South Park, where there will be a party from till 4 p.m. And that's the Lawrence Earth Day information right here on your community radio station. Sabor Latino is coming up, so you're certainly welcome to keep it here. But if you're interested in more environmental programming, the community radio station across the state, KDHX, it will be starting their Earthworms program at 7 p.m., kdhx.org. And do keep it here. And remember to support KKFI in the band auction. The band auction resumes again tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. with Scott Ford. We're going to go out with a couple of messages and then World Ocean Radio.
On the next Making Contact, reporter Daniel Grossman takes us to India in the heat of the moment. Sea level rise, Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
On the next Bioneers.
Asked why, Cesar responded, "Because there is something even more important to farm workers than the benefits unionization brings. Because there is something more important to the farm workers' union than winning better wages and working conditions. That is protecting farm workers and consumers from systematic poisoning through the reckless use of agricultural toxins."
Friday morning, 9:30.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
World Ocean Radio.
Radio Ya Bahari Dunia.
Radio de l'Océan.
La Radio Océano del Mundo.
Champion de l'Océan.
Sayansi Bahari.
Solutions to today's ocean issues.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. We are overwhelmed by the daily litany of environmental disaster. We see the pictures and hear the voices of places and people whose lives have been affected by the global compulsion to grow, not just to meet the needs of ever-increasing population, but also to feed a system driven by unrestrained consumption of goods and services derived from the excessive and unsustainable extraction of natural resources. Knowing full well the inevitable collapse of such a society, we nevertheless carry on, indifferent to the destruction around us, the alternative possibilities, and the exponential risk to the lives of our children. The world, even from the most privileged perspective, looks nervous, angry, delimited, lost. We ask ourselves, what can we do? And we can do some things for ourselves, for others, for the local community, even for causes we believe can make some contribution toward far greater change and improvement. But these efforts often seem insubstantial, inefficient, disconnected from the larger need to manage our way, from the evident failure of past systems and ideas to the very different limited world of the future that cannot survive without a new paradigm around which to organize a successful civilized response to the needs of a new age. As I've argued before, we need a plan, and we need a principled strategy to base it on. I have proposed the ocean, water, and water cycles as that paradigm, as a galvanizing strategy with a compelling logic and application that will release us from the addiction to fossil fuels and connect us to new values and behaviors that will guide us as we enter the turbulent unknowns of the 21st century. Think for this moment on just what it is we want and how we can achieve it in a democratic society based on the rule of law. Is it hydraulic society as proposed here, or is it another idea, a better idea that meets the mandate for change and viability as a system beyond? Whichever, we need a new idea and system of law that will enable an alternative to collapse or chaos. As an advocate for the ocean, I have been unable to establish the principle and precedent on which such a system of law might be based. Until now. With the discovery of a fresh and astonishing contribution to the discussion by Mary Christina Wood, professor of environmental law at the University of Oregon, in her book Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age, published in 2014 by Cambridge University Press. Permit me this metaphor. In designing the gateway to the future, the components of an imagined arch may be in place as elements of content, standards of performance and behavior, the most useful technologies, the financial assets in place, and the workers straining to build an edifice like never before. But without the keystone, the architecture will fail. I see all the blocks in place save one, the one that will provide the incontrovertible vector of support to enable the construction to stand and endure over the challenging circumstances of time. Professor Wood asks two fundamental questions about environmental law. First, does the field of law work to keep society in compliance with nature's own laws? Second, Can it be effective in confirming the ecologic challenges now coming at us at horrifying speed? Her answer to both is a resounding yes, based on, and here is where I found the breakthrough surprise, principles established as far back as Roman law, rooted again in English common law, incorporated in the U.S. Constitution, manifest in the governing documents of other nations, and providing a system of principle and precedent on which environmental legislation and the mission of governmental environment agencies were predicated in the 1970s, when the need for conservation and regulation became evident, and the conservation ethic, its definition, practice, and implementation that evolved. The keystone principle is known as the public trust document, which, quote, rests on a civic and judicial understanding that some natural resources remain so vital to the public welfare and human survival that they could not fall exclusively to private property ownership and control. Under the public trust document, natural resources such as waters, wildlife, and presumably air remain common property belonging to the people as a whole. Such assets take the form of a perpetual trust for future generations, unquote. Is not such a doctrine exactly what we need? And there it lies, to hand. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is produced by the World Ocean Observatory. Find our podcast on iTunes and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.